We'll turn to our next case, United States versus Korber. Here's the sheet here. That's number 19-4147. Mr. Baldwin, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Hold on. I'm not. Make sure Judge Carson is available.
I'm here. I'm just grabbing a piece of paper.
Okay. Well, we don't have as much desk space as we do on the bench in Denver, so that's why I couldn't find the list, and Judge Carson needed some more paper. So, okay, Mr. Baldwin, if you would proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Dick Baldwin. I represent appellant Claude Korber. There are numerous grounds for reversing and vacating Mr. Korber's conviction in this case. It should weigh extremely heavily on this court's mind that we sit here 12 years after he was first indicted, however. And when deciding what to do about those errors, the Sixth Amendment, severe Sixth Amendment concerns should prompt this court to also dismiss with prejudice when reversing. The first error I'd like to discuss is probably the most obvious, and that is Judge Shelby's refusal to give preclusive effect to Judge Wadhams' prior suppression order. Now, this court's recent decision in Arterbury made this argument fairly straightforward and simple. Straightforward application of that case resolves it entirely because there the court held that a prior suppression order has preclusive effect in subsequent stages of the same criminal prosecution, especially where, just as here, the government had appealed that suppression order in the first proceeding and voluntarily dismissed its opportunity to challenge that decision, and it therefore then has preclusive effect going forward.
But you're missing one big point there, which, of course, is in Arterbury, the government folded the tent. And in your case, the government said, let's get a trial date.
Absolutely. Now, the Supreme Court, in describing this notion, which the government has pointed out through the Bice decision, has talked about the role, the critical factor here, which is the incentive to appeal. It's not whether or not the government is willing to proceed and that somehow prevents them from having this prior decision having preclusive effect, or to state it differently, simply because you decide to proceed doesn't mean you then get to relitigate the things that were decided against you in future litigation. And 17 years after Justice Ginsburg authored the Bice decision, she authored Bravo Fernandez. And in that case, she described why that sort of principle is so important and explains what was happening in Bice. And that is that she described that in the criminal context, the lack of appellate review for the government in an acquittal context, which is largely the way that this shakes out, means that the government doesn't have a chance to appeal that decision. And so it results in the issue preclusion test applying in different ways in the criminal context. Now, with a suppression order, just as Arterbury concluded, the dynamic is diametrically opposed to that. It's the exact opposite, which is that the government has the sole statutory authority to appeal a suppression order. And that makes them much more like a civil litigant who does have the opportunity to have that decision reviewed by the appellate court. And if they decide to forego that, just like the court or just like the government did in Arterbury, they are bound by it. And that's consistent with the Supreme Court's precedent. And perhaps more importantly, that understanding of the rule is consistent with this court's application of the issue preclusion test in other contexts. And those cases would be wrongly decided under the government's view of the test.
Well, let's talk about the test for issue preclusion, because as a general matter, in common law, issue preclusion requires that the issue be essential to the determination.
Correct.
And that is clear in Atterbury. It was the death knell. Suppressing the evidence removed any possibility of prosecution. Here, the decision that was made to dismiss the case was under the Speedy Trial Act. There were two steps to that dismissal. One step, the one finding that it should be dismissed with prejudice, that was reversed by this court. So that has no issue preclusive effect. And the first step in the Speedy Trial Act analysis was whether the act was violated. And the suppression, the merits of the suppression motion had nothing to do with that determination. It certainly wasn't essential to it. Maybe it had a little bit to do. It certainly wasn't essential. It might have been much more important on whether the dismissal should be with prejudice. But as I mentioned, that was reversed by this court. So how do you satisfy the essential, in quotes, requirement?
A number of ways, Your Honor. And respectfully, I wholeheartedly disagree with your characterization of the essentiality. And the government does too. At page 32 of their brief, they conceded that Judge Waddup's linked the misconduct to his decision to dismiss.
To dismiss with prejudice.
No, his dismissal. They say that they then challenged whether or not it was essential, but they concede that it was a component of his decision to dismiss. And they then appealed just the prejudice.
I'm not sure they did concede that when I looked at it, but it's also, was it essential?
Yes, it was. In addition to that, Judge Waddup thought so. At page...
Certainly with respect to whether it should be with prejudice, but in terms of whether the act was violated, the act was violated regardless of whether the time for the appeal is considered or not. And the problem with the appeal, insofar as the Speedy Trial Act is concerned, had nothing to do with the merits of the appeal.
That's not how Judge Waddup saw it. He expressly linked the delays to the misconduct, and the delays were the basis for the dismissal, not the prejudice determination. It applied to both. That doesn't mean that it didn't apply to the decision to dismiss. That's at volume 9, pages 2201 and 02 of the record. And perhaps more importantly, Judge Hartz, in an opinion from this court that you authored, Knight v. Mooring Capital Fund, this court considered the essential to component of issue preclusion. And in that case, it was a civil case. In that case, there was a jury determination, a jury verdict, that was a split verdict that granted or that found liability for both the plaintiff and the defendant in a variety of tort and contract claims. Subsequent to the jury verdict, the parties moved for fees. And the party A alleged that party B had engaged in bad faith and should get a little bit of extra fees. The court granted both parties fees, but declined to find there was bad faith and therefore declined to award the extra fees. So then party A files a second lawsuit, a RICO suit, claiming that party B's bad faith led to increased litigation costs. And in your opinion, you explained that bad faith finding had preclusive effect because it was, quote, the adjudication was, quote, necessary and essential to the court's determination of the parties' motion for fees and costs. So there's a couple of errors there. First, the essentiality test is that it's material, not that it is dispositive. Second, the outcome that you're looking at is not the outcome of the entire proceeding. It's whether or not it was a fully decided issue that from which the party could have appealed. And if they didn't appeal, just like in Arterbury, they're bound by it.
The whole point is the reason the essentialness is one of the reasons for requiring essentialness is we don't want to encourage people to appeal when they have a very weak ground that would be dispositive, even though there's another ground that would bother them and they think it's wrong, but they're probably going to lose the appeal anyway. So why waste everyone's time with an appeal? So if it's not dispositive, if there's an alternative ground for losing, then you don't want to make people appeal. Now, that's a very debated point. Justice Alito criticized that view in a concurrence or dissent not long ago. But that's the common law rule as stated in the restatement second of judgments. And it's not just that you could have appealed it. It's that you had an incentive to appeal it.
They certainly did here, Your Honor. They did appeal and they chose to dismiss.
Okay, so let me break in and ask you a question that I think may tie in with Judge Hartz's line of questioning to you. when the government did appeal that, they didn't just get to file an appeal, even if they maybe thought it was a weak issue, right? They had to certify that this was an issue that was material and that could absolutely have an effect on the case. What's the nature of that certification, and how does that play into what Judge Hartz is talking about?
It's a statutory requirement that the government certifies that the suppression order involves evidence of a substantial evidence of a material fact. And they are statutorily required under Section 3731 to make that certification before they, in order to appeal a suppression order.
But the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't have authority to do that. The institution that has to approve this type of appeal is the Solicitor General's Office, or at least the Criminal Division of the Justice Department, and that's why it was withdrawn. They didn't have authority to do it. Am I right? Am I wrong about that?
You're correct. The Solicitor General declined to authorize the appeal. That does not mean that the Solicitor General is the person who certifies. The U.S. Attorney's Office is the one who signed the certification that this was substantial evidence of a material fact. The Solicitor General's Office has the discretion to decide whether or not to approve a U.S. attorney from proceeding with the appeal. That does not mean that the U.S. Attorney's Office did not believe it was important, or that it had the incentive, or that it in fact did try to appeal.
And let me just follow up with that a couple of follow up questions. I mean, the U.S. when they withdrew their appeal, they didn't withdraw their certification and basically admit to the court that it was erroneous, or that they didn't have authority to make the certification. They just withdrew it and said that the solicitor hadn't approved it, so they had to withdraw it.
That's right, Judge Carson.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
I would just quickly add, I want to move to a different point, but one other point.
There are a lot of issues in this case. Don't worry about the clock right now.
Okay. All right. I am worried about the clock, so thank you, Your Honor.
Let's vet this issue thoroughly. I think Judge Phillips wants to ask a question. I may be misreading.
Yes. One problem with what I'm hearing your argument is you're making it sound like Judge Waddup's dismissed solely on this basis, but there were all kinds of delays in this case, heaven knows. And this was one of those. He very well may have dismissed even had this not occurred, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
I, to be clear, I am not arguing that Judge Waddup's decision was solely based on that. I wholeheartedly reject the government's view that issue preclusion requires that the issue is dispositive. And this court has done the same thing. Again,
well, isn't that the same thing as essentiality?
No, it's not. The court has used essentiality again to be a way of triangulating what the important issues are that give a party the incentive to want to try to appeal it, which helps to that's how we balance those concerns against promoting unnecessary appeals versus ensuring the critical appeals.
So it can be essential for issue preclusion, but be just one factor in dismissing the case.
Absolutely. And I think any other view of that would collapse the distinction between issue preclusion into claim preclusion. If it's dispositive, you're talking about claim preclusion, not issue preclusion. And this court has...
No, that's not true. The issue preclusion is different because you can use it when there are different claims involved.
Not if it's it would have to be dispositive. It couldn't be dispositive. So imagine a Lanham Act claim where a party, the plaintiff alleges there was false advertising and the other party breached a contract, but the court disagrees on both of those. There was no false statement and the other party never signed the agreement. That there's not a single issue, but those issues were both fully decided. And so deciding that they could relitigate the question of whether they signed the contract would conflict with this court's reasoning and issue preclusion.
Maybe that's a lawsuit against another party.
It may be.
That couldn't be claim preclusion when it's a different party.
No, but attempting to assert it again defensively, it would collapse into claim preclusion. The non-mutual versus offensive and defensive is another interesting dividing line with issue preclusion, where it's mutual defensive collateral estoppel, which is what was happening in Arterbury and which is happening here, is where preclusion doctrines are at their strength. Now, in the criminal context, the inability to appeal an acquittal is an important layer, but that's not present here. And the dynamic is exactly reversed because only the government could have appealed the suppression order. They tried to, and they can't relitigate it again under Arterbury. And an interesting counterpoint to that is how this court has looked at suppression orders in the 1983 context. There, where a criminal defendant asserted a constitutional violation in a motion to suppress, and that was denied, this court has said that they are precluded from asserting a 1983 claim based on those constitutional violations going forward. That's not dispositive as to the outcome of their criminal prosecution any more than it is far less dispositive than Judge Wadops' conclusions about misconduct were here. And I think an important point that I want to make is that thinking about, there's a bit of a dilemma that the government has here, which is even if we accept their view of this test, that it requires that the court relied on this misconduct in a way that was essential when deciding whether to dismiss with or without prejudice. This court remanded with instructions telling the district court that it had to rely on those facts when deciding whether to dismiss with or without prejudice. And either it did or it didn't. And perhaps that's an important question the court needs to answer, is whether or not the court really did rely on those facts as an essential part of its analysis, like this court instructed. If it did, then that decision does have preclusive effect going forward under Arterbury, even under the government's extreme view. If it didn't, then Judge Parrish erred when reweighing the prejudice factors.
Counsel, wrap up what you're going to say on this issue very quickly in 20 seconds, and then I'll give you some time to address other issues.
Well, that was me trying to artfully transition over to the speedy trial issues.
Okay.
That, you know, even if we accept...
You don't have to be artful. You can be straightforward and you may get your way.
Well, so either way, even if we accept the government's test, there's an error here, either in not enforcing the suppression order or in the way that the court then handled the suppression issues in the prejudice determination when dismissing. And her flaw, the flaw of Judge Parrish in that prejudice analysis is that she failed to make any findings or engage in any way with the relationship between the conduct at play that led to the delays. And this court has talked about the importance of looking at those root causes when a court is evaluating the reasons for a speedy trial delay. That's in United States versus Black, which is 830 F3rd 1099, where this court not only said that the root cause is an important factor, it even went so far as to say that where a criminal defendant has been found to be culpable for more than 50% of the delay, if the root cause is the government's conduct, that factor still can weigh in favor of dismissal for the defendant. And here, even accepting Judge Parrish's faulty findings that Mr. Kerber is responsible for half of the delays, there are findings of misconduct to show that his delays were reactive to what the government was doing, and there is a relationship there that shows that the root cause was the government's misconduct, whether it was withholding discovery, which is something that Kerber could not possibly share culpability for, whether it was the government's decision to improperly rely on privileged materials, which took 2.5 years for them to issue an indictment that did not rely in some way on a privileged document, whether it was their decisions to attempt to intrude into the attorney-client relationship that led to the suppression order in the first place. These are all events that caused delay that led Mr. Kerber to litigate these issues, and for which he could not possibly share culpability for the root cause of those delays. And so under United States versus Black, that factor should weigh very heavily in favor of dismissal with prejudice. And the prejudice determination is particularly salient here, where the delay at the point that the court was evaluating prejudice had already been 7 years. Now, under Judge Parrish's reasoning, she attributes only half of that to the government. So there are only 3.5 years of delay at that point. The problem from where we stand now is that decision has now been 7 years in the past. And so moving forward, given that there is an unavoidable error here, depending upon how the court decides Judge Parrish dealt with those findings in the prejudice determination, the court has to decide what to do going forward. And those 7 years, even if we assume that those 7 years should be divided equally again by the government and Kerber, adding the 2.5 years to that 3.5 years gets us to the 6-year presumption that there is a there's a Sixth Amendment speedy trial prejudice problem here.
Are you aware of any authority that says where there's an extraordinary delay that just because it's maybe 50-50 that, you know, the tie sort of goes to the government and it ends up in a without prejudice dismissal?
I'm not. Instead, this court in many cases seem to suggest the opposite, depending upon what the reasons were. You know, your question is about extreme delay. I would say in cases of extreme delay, courts seem to treat extreme delay as almost a third rail. That they have drawn a hard line to try to avoid those cases of extreme delay, because the suggestion seems to be that where the Sixth Amendment will swing into action where there has been such an extreme delay, that is, I mean, obviously a constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment is, that's a heavy hand to bring down in a case. But where the delay has been so extreme, courts seem to be very wary to let the tie go to the government. That said,
this seems to me to be a case where the delay is pretty extreme. I mean, this is a long-standing case.
I wholeheartedly.
What's your best case on that?
Well, so this court's decision in Taylor says that anything but an unwitting violation weighs in favor. The presumption for 6 years. I'm sorry. Let me find where that is. The presumption for 6 years is from this court's Larson decision, 627 F3rd 1198. And the another factor that I think should be important is that the extreme delay here not only is the time that had led up to this court's last decision and the two trials that have occurred since then, but if there's a remand here, depending upon the grounds, the Sixth Amendment concerns are going to become overwhelming. If the reversal is based on the Arterbury, the lack of suppression, there's going to have to be a fruits hearing to decide what evidence the government even can use to prosecute Mr. Kerber. There will likely be some pretrial motions about whether or not the government at that point even has enough evidence to proceed. There will almost certainly be Sixth Amendment motions saying that at that point it's just too long and it needs to be done. There'd have to be another trial. I mean, this court would have to issue its decision between now and then. There are significant proceedings that would happen if this court entertains a remand. This case is an unseemly spectacle, and this court should put it to bed.
Thank you. I think we've given you plenty of time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I need to ask you one question. In your argument on essentiality, you cited an opinion by someone using my name. And could you give me the cite to that case, please?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd be happy to submit a 28-J letter with the couple of cases I mentioned here. But the one that I mentioned that you authored.
They weren't in your brief. Is that right?
Right. This one was not in the brief.
Okay. That's what surprised me. Okay.
Yep.
Good.
It is consistent with our argument, but it's not in the brief. So the cite for the case that you authored is 749 F3rd 1180, and that's Knight v. Mooring Capital Fund.
Okay.
And then the 1983 cases where the court has found suppression orders were preclusive even when they were denied is there were two that Judge Matheson issued last year, 814 Federal Appendix 325. And 815 Federal Appendix 227, and then an older one, 122 Federal Appendix 899.
Okay, thank you.
May I ask one question that should
for
more than a 30-second response, which is, I'm confused by your argument on 3288. Can you just succinctly say what the government needed to do to comply with that statute? Savings clause. Saving statute.
The government needed to have reindicted within 60 days of Judge Parrish's decision.
Okay, that's what I thought your answer would be. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tenney.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Ryan Tenney, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. Subject to questions or direction from the court, I'll just go in the order that Mr. Baldwin went. I'll start with the issue preclusion issue, and then I'll move from there to the Speedy Trial Act issues, and then proceed accordingly. The argument that Mr. Baldwin made in his reply brief and that he stressed today is that it's sort of a combination of either that there is no essentiality element or that if it is, it really folds into the first element of issue preclusion. And at a bare minimum, he's suggesting that it's not linked to the final outcome of the case. We think he's wrong on the merits, but we think there's a prefatory reason why the court shouldn't go there at all. It's that he both invited any such error below and he waived it in his opening brief. Let me start with invited error. When Judge Shelby asked for briefing, supplemental briefing on issue preclusion, the government argued, volume 12, page 3053 of the record, that the reason that issue preclusion did not apply was that the suppression ruling, quote, played no role in the dismissal of the first indictment, so it could be reconsidered in the next case. At the hearing on this issue, Judge Shelby asked defense counsel whether she agreed that there was an essentiality component to issue preclusion. And at the supplemental appendix at page 108, this is what defense counsel said, quote, it has to be essential to the judgment. These are all common law principles. It has to be essential. So at a bare minimum, she conceded below that there is an essentiality element. So Mr. Kerber respectfully can't make the argument now that there is no such element. So what I understand him to be doing is saying, well, there is something that sounds like an essentiality element, but it's not linked to the final outcome. Here's the problem with that procedurally. He didn't make that argument in his opening brief. And that would be excusable, of course, under appellate norms if this was something that we had come up with on our own in our appellee's brief, but it wasn't. This was the centerpiece of Judge Shelby's ruling. Judge Shelby discussed it for two full pages of transcript at volume 31, pages 72, 89 to 91. These are his words. He said this was, quote, the determining factor on issue preclusion. He cited Bobby versus Beast by name. He even gave the reporter citation. This was the only element of issue preclusion that he said was not met. And he gave a very specific version of the essentiality element. He held, volume 31, page 7291, that the essentiality element was not satisfied because the outcome of the suppression ruling was, quote, irrelevant to the decision that caused the dismissal of the first case. So the ruling at issue was Judge Shelby's ruling that issue preclusion did not apply because the suppression ruling was not linked to the outcome of the case, meaning the Speedy Trial Act dismissal. So if Mr. Kerber was going to challenge that ruling, he had to make his arguments in his opening brief. In his opening brief, he sort of has a glancing discussion of this on page 26. And he says that the essentiality element was met because, quote, the suppression order was necessary to the dismissal. But here's what he didn't say. He never came in and said, look, the element changes based on whether it was based on the common law or double jeopardy. He never said it's not linked to the final outcome of the case. It's only linked internally to the ruling itself. So the whole first 12 pages or so of his reply brief and all these arguments that he's made, they're new. And we've got responses to them. We think he's misreading the case law. But as an appellant, he's required to challenge the grounds that the district court gave. And the district court said issue preclusion doesn't apply because suppression wasn't linked to dismissal. And if he thought that that was wrong procedurally, or if he thought that that was a misreading of Beast, or if he thought that that was a misreading of how essentiality works, he was required to put that into his opening brief so that we could respond in writing rather than having to come into argument and do it for the first time. We think he's waived it. We think for purposes of this appeal, he's stuck with the version that Judge Shelby gave and which he did not contest, which is that essentiality is linked to the dismissal.
Let me ask you this. When Judge Shelby decided that, I haven't compared the dates, was Arterbury decided?
I believe it was before Arterbury.
Okay. So, I mean, one of the things that I think you're glossing over is that Mr. Baldwin's, his argument is premised on Arterbury and, you know, what he views as its lack of a requirement for this strong essentiality element. And so if that's true, and that case hadn't even been issued at the time Judge Shelby decided it, I mean, how are you going to say that he waived it when he brings it up here by not putting it in his opening brief? And then when you bring it back up and say, no, we disagree, that is still here. I mean, isn't it fair game for him to now address that in his reply brief?
Well, Judge Carson, I think that the chronology that you're referring to might in theory get him around the invited error problem, but I don't think it gets him at all around the appellate waiver problem. Because what matters there is whether whether it existed at the time that he filed his opening brief. When he files his opening brief, he's challenging Judge Shelby's ruling. This is the basis of Judge Shelby's ruling. And so if he wants to come into his opening brief and say, you know, Judge Shelby didn't have the benefit of Arterbury, and Arterbury makes it clear that this element doesn't apply this way, then that would have been an argument that we could have responded to. And then we could have done the Arterbury versus Beast analysis as to the essentiality elements components. Well, but he didn't make that argument.
You didn't appear to miss that in your own brief.
No, because Judge Shelby's ruling helped us.
Head on, right? Even without it.
Right. Yeah. But our point is, if he thinks that Arterbury somehow distinguished or altered the Beast standard, which is the standard that Judge Shelby expressly invoked by name, then he was required to make that argument in his opening brief, and he didn't.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask you another question. Please. So what would your position be in this case if you guys, the government, had appealed the grant of the motion to suppress, the solicitor had not come in and made you withdraw your appeal, it had been fully briefed and decided by the court, and the grant of the motion was upheld? What would your position be today?
In terms of the issue preclusion component?
Yes.
And then if the case was then dismissed on Speedy Trial Act grounds that were unrelated to the suppression ruling.
Yep.
You
took it up all the way and fully litigated it and received an adverse decision.
I don't mean to duck your question, Your Honor, but I'm going to duck your question because I think it's unavoidable to duck your question, because if a court in a subsequent case came in and disagreed with you on suppression, it would be reversed on that ground anyway. I don't think we'd ever have an issue preclusion fight in that scenario. Because at that point, you'd have a binding decision.
The case or just binding precedent?
You'd have binding precedent on the merits of the suppression issue. And so if the case were refiled, if you got through the issue preclusion component and the case were then refiled and the suppression issue were relitigated, you'd have a Tenth Circuit decision under your hypothetical saying this is the law on the suppression issue. So I don't think anybody would ever bother with issue preclusion.
Let's stop for a minute. So how is that materially different here? Because what you have is a District of Utah case ruling on the precise issue. And I realize there's some other things floating around out here, but this just sort of bothers me.
Yeah.
And you appealed it and you certified that it was a material issue. And I've noticed that in your brief, you attempt to sort of say, well, yeah, we certified it was material, but we had other evidence. Sure you did. Well, if it wasn't important, why did you appeal it? Is sort of the problem I see. But anyway, you appeal. Ultimately, you dismiss your appeal and the district court's decision stands, at least as far as it went with Judge Wadhams. I mean, to me, that puts you in the same place as if we would have ruled on it and affirmed it, because it's final. It's done. You took it up. By dismissing your appeal, you essentially conceded it.
No, Your Honor, with respect, I disagree with that formulation, and here's why. There are a lot of different things that any party is looking at when it's thinking of filing an interlocutory appeal. One of them, certainly, and I think this is the premise of your question, is the merits. Do we think the ruling was wrong? How wrong is it? How likely is it? Do we think that the appellate courts can reverse? But there are other things that a court or that a litigant is looking at, in particular the government. We're looking at how long is the appeal going to take? Do we have victims who need resolution and so forth and so forth? And so you can have a scenario, and I'll suggest to you that this is the scenario here, where a party is thinking maybe we should appeal, maybe we shouldn't. They file the appeal and then they change their mind. Now here, the dynamic that you're pointing to is that the SG is the entity that changed the mind, but that's what happened. But there was good reason that had nothing to do with the merits for doing that.
Where's the reason in the record?
Well, we didn't give the reason, but we don't have to give the reason for withdrawing our appeal.
I understand you're trying to tell me, well, you have to, you know, for all you know, Judge, it could have been because we were worried about it taking too long for the victims. Right. We made some other internal decision that we didn't want to do it. It for all I know, it had nothing to do with the merits, or maybe you thought you were going to get poured out here, and maybe you thought then you were going to be stuck with it. Then you couldn't go back and try to convince another judge or somebody that it was okay when you re-indicted.
Right. Two things there, Your Honor. First of all, Ash versus Swenson on issue preclusion talks about looking at the circumstances of the case. And here, I'm going to push back a little bit on part of your hypothetical there. We know what the government tried to do here because the government did it immediately after withdrawing its appeal. Almost immediately, the government said, let's go to trial right now. And so we know that whatever it was that was driving the government's thinking was not going to force the government to try to get out of this case or even get out of Judge Wadups, because at that point, Judge Wadups hadn't recused. What the government said to Judge Wadups was, let's go to trial right now. And so whatever the government was doing or not doing, the government was clearly ready to go to trial, which makes it fundamentally different. The second part of your concern, Judge, is the forum shopping concern raised in the reply brief. And let me just address that head on. Mr. Kerber is asking you to not apply the essentiality element from the Supreme Court based on concerns that this will lead the government to game playing. We don't like a suppression ruling. We're gonna maneuver a dismissal, try to get it refiled, and off we go. And that's the way. There are already procedural roadblocks that effectively prevent us from doing that. That is not a concern you should have.
So
the starting place is rule. I've got three of them. The starting place is Rule 48A. Rule 48A does not allow the government to unilaterally dismiss its own prosecution. We have to give reasons. There's a decision. We would have cited to it if Mr. Baldwin had made this argument in his opening brief. There's a decision, United States versus Durr, D-E-R-R, from 1984 from this court. It's a published decision that interprets the scope of the Rule 48A analysis. And what it says is, if the government moves to withdraw its case, to dismiss its own indictment, and it gives reasons, and the district court does not like the reasons, it can deny the request. And it even goes beyond that. And it says that if the district court allows dismissal of the first case, the case somehow gets reindicted, and the second judge in the second case thinks that he or she doesn't like the reasons the government gave for dismissing the first case, they can dismiss the second case. So if what we're trying to do is get around a suppression ruling, we have to come up with a reason that doesn't sound like forum shopping so that the judge will sign off on it. But then you run into the practical problems. Here are the two practical problems. Problem number one is there's no guarantee we're going to get anything, because there's absolutely no guarantee that we're going to get a new judge on reassignment, or that the new judge will see the suppression issue any differently at all. And then there's a third problem, which is that the district court benches in this circuit and most circuits are relatively small. So if the United States Attorney's Office gets into a practice of routinely dismissing its own cases, refiling them, and it appears to the district court bench that what we're trying to do is get around suppression rulings, to put it mildly, that's not going to help our long-term institutional interests. And so this notion that if what we want to do is get out of a suppression ruling, what we're going to do is manufacture a dismissal for reasons other than that, and then hope that we get a new judge and hope that the new judge sees the suppression issue differently and hope that we survive Rule 48A and hope that the judges don't hold this against us, I don't think is realistic. And Rule 48A is already the roadblock.
I'll take your word for it. I don't want to use all your time on this.
Yeah. Our bottom line point, before I move to the Speedy Trial Act stuff, we don't think that he's allowed to argue the essentiality gets you beyond the outcome determinative thing. We understand that there's a lot of complexity to issue preclusion, but if you do nothing more than take Bobby versus Beast at its word, Bobby versus Beast uses the phrase, this is the phrase, a determination ranks as necessary or essential only when the final outcome hinges on it, hinges. And then it uses the phrase final outcome. And if you simply apply that there, the final outcome in this case was a dismissal without prejudice. That was the final outcome. Okay. And that did not hinge.
Well, that's the merits of the issue.
Right, right.
We haven't addressed that.
Okay.
Explain why Mr. Baldwin is vigorously arguing that, in fact, the decision by the U.S. Attorney's Office to appeal and then not appeal was essential to the first step of Judge Wadup's dismissal on Speedy Trial Act grounds. That it was an important factor or an essential factor in determining that the Speedy Trial Act was violated. Would you respond to that?
Yeah, and if I missed the angle, please redirect me, because there's multiple things going on there. You have the dismissal part, and then you have the prejudice part.
Yes.
The dismissal part has to be based on timing. The Speedy Trial Act is a timing statute. And there's a danger that runs through some of the briefing here of conflating two different things. Mm-hmm. Timing problems with the sort of overall specter of the case. I think that the concerns that Judge Wadup had about the interviews and the alleged unethical misconduct and so forth, that really went to the prejudice component. But when we're talking about the dismissal, that's just purely a function of how many days were excluded, how many days lapsed. His discussion of the dismissal component in the ruling is fairly brief. It's two pages. What it really came down to is the government had conceded in a hearing that if a few of the particular ends of justice orders were not excludable, that it lost on timing. And then Judge Waddup says at the beginning of his ruling, they're not excludable, and that ended it. And so
were any of those ends of justice orders, did any of them concern the suppression?
I don't recall offhand. So I don't know that I can answer that right now. But this, I think, gets to our point, and this is going to bleed over into the speedy trial discussion, which I wanted to make sure I had. I know we're out of time here. When we're talking about number of days, and even to a large extent when we're talking about the prejudice component, the Speedy Trial Act is about timing. A defendant can be successful on every single motion that he files, but if he files them in a delayed manner, if he files them at the very last minute and files them seriatim, and by doing so delays the case, the government can hardly be held responsible for the delays associated with the case, even if the defendant is successful in his motion. So whether the government acted improperly, thus leading to suppression of the evidence, is not the issue. The issue is whether, based on the timing of how things were litigated, the case A should have been dismissed and then B should have been dismissed with prejudice. And if I may, I'd like to respond to the very particular claim.
You've got some more time.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure I got to this, which is why I tried to reserve it at the beginning. This question of whether the government can be held responsible for all, let alone most, or let alone any, of the continuance requests that Mr. Kerber made, because he doesn't dispute in his reply brief, and I don't think he can on the record, that Mr. Kerber requested and or acquiesced to a very large number of continuances in this case. I can't find a Speedy Trial Act or Speedy Trial constitutional claim anywhere like this where a defendant agreed to anywhere remotely near this number of delays and then somehow prevailed. And so he tries to get around this by making this broad generalized claim that, well, the government's responsible for this because it acted unethically. So therefore, all of my continuances actually fall on the government, not me. Let me give you a list of examples from the extant record. And we don't have a record. We don't have transcripts of all the many, many hearings over the 10 years. Let me just give you a list I compiled over the last few days of the ones that we have on this record where the reasons that Kerber gave on the record for his own continuance requests were independent of government action. On August 4th, 2009, he asked for a 1 to 2 month continuance because his counsel had a 3-week trial in California. That has nothing to do with us. And I can give record citations for any of these if you'd like them. On January 27th, 2010, his counsel asked for a 3-month continuance and he explained that he was still reviewing discovery. On February 17th, 2010, he asked for 2 to 3 more months, again explaining that he was still reviewing discovery. On August 31st, 2010, he asked for 5 more months, again explaining that he was still reviewing discovery. On November 16th, 2010, he asked for time, again explaining he still hadn't finished reviewing discovery. On December 15th, 2010, he asked for a continuance of the motion deadline, quote, until further notice. And this is the quote he gave, because I'm still reviewing and analyzing the voluminous discovery provided by the government in this case. On November 15th, 2011, he asked for 5 more months to file motions, explaining, quote, we have been litigating issues that have been presented. Okay, maybe the last one, but the previous ones where he's repeatedly telling the courts, I need more time because I haven't reviewed everything that I've gotten. Okay,
So let's take that. So what if we get into this record and it appears that you've been trickling out the discovery and that it's apparent from the record that one of the reasons why he's needed more time to review discovery is because of the way you've produced it. Well, I mean, that's the problem with, you know, your bullet points here is they're not real clear.
Okay. So, well, let me respond to that.
Yeah. That was almost rhetorical. So I'm not even sure you can answer it, but
I'd like to, if I may though.
Go ahead.
Right. If what Mr. Mumford, who was his counsel at the time, was saying to the court in all these hearings was, the government still hasn't given me all the discovery and I can't make litigation decisions until it does, that would be the premise of your question, Judge Carson. But what he's instead saying is, I haven't even reviewed what I've gotten.
Right. Okay. Well, so fair enough. So, but he, as taking your first point, he did make some claims like that.
Well, he's making them. And if you go to those hearings, just to head off the 28-J response, if you go to those hearings, he's saying multiple things in these hearings. He's saying, look, the government's given me a ton of discovery. I haven't looked at it all. Also, we've got all these motions that we're litigating, so let's just stop everything until we're done. So he's saying both things. But our point is, if what you're looking at for timing purposes is who's responsible for the delay, and he's saying, I haven't even read the stuff I've gotten, then if we had given him more or more quickly, then it's not going to speed anything up. It's just going to keep slowing it down because he's not even reading what we've given him.
Well, it sounds to me like your position is that you could engage in abusive conduct and that it wouldn't matter if the delay on reviewing it and discovering that your conduct was abusive was his problem.
I think it would matter, but it would get into the holistic analysis that the Speedy Trial Act Factor 2 asks for. I mean, what Kerber 1 says, in the opinion two members of this panel wrote, it has this line quoting the United States Supreme Court's Taylor decision that says that a defendant who, quote, waits passively while the time runs or, quote, acquiesces to the postponement of his case doesn't have a claim to with prejudice dismissal. So if what you have, Judge Carson, is government abusive litigation practices, there's all kinds of remedies for that. But if what you have simultaneously is a defendant who's acquiescing or who's sitting on his hands himself, then that defendant doesn't get a timing-based dismissal. But then there's a broader systemic point. It's not just these continuance requests. There's a broader problem, and it's the one that Kerber 1 identified, specific as a whole paragraph devoted to this, which is that even aside from the continuance request, which we think alone is enough to defeat his claim here, you have the nature of his motion practice. The early case was driven really by three motions. It was driven by his protective order motion, his suppression motion, and then his timing motions. And the record already tells us that he delayed filing all three by years past when he could have filed all three of those motions. The indictment is filed in May of 2009. The indictment contains one of the charges is based on the privileged letter, the to our lenders letter. So he knows as of May 2009 that the government has this letter, and he doesn't file the motion for protective order, as this court noted in Kerber 1. He doesn't file that motion until February 2010. So even there, he's waited 9 months to file a motion that he knows is coming. Then you have the suppression issue. He knows from the moment he's interviewed that he didn't have counsel, and he knows that that interview happened. In August of 2010, we've pointed this out in the brief, his counsel told the court that he was going to file this motion on this basis. In November of 2011, he said again, this is going to come. And he doesn't file the suppression motion until July of 2012. He's going to claim in rebuttal, because he sort of hints at it in reply, that no, he didn't know the operative facts, specifically that the government AUSAs had scripted questions and so forth. But here's the thing, we didn't learn that until the evidentiary hearing on the suppression motion. So if he'd filed the suppression motion earlier, we would have learned that earlier.
That's a little bit disingenuous, isn't it? Because you guys were in the middle of it. All the things he was complaining about that he was saying he was going to file motions about, you, and maybe not you personally, but people in your office and the agents had engaged in the underlying conduct. So you knew what he was talking about. You knew what it all arose from. It was...
Right. I hope I didn't say anything disingenuous.
It's not like you didn't find out what happened until he sprung it on you. Conduct you were aware of and then participated in.
Right. But this is the point that we're making is the claim that he's making is not substantive based on the suppression. I mean, that you get the remedy for the suppression motion in the suppression motion. The remedy he's asking for is a timing-based dismissal.
I get that, but your argument to me was not just timing, it was substantive, because he sat on this knowing about it the whole time, and that you guys didn't even find out really until he said it.
Oh, no, I don't mean to suggest the latter part at all. It's the former part that I think is dispositive to the point that I'm trying to make.
Right. I get that point. I don't want to belabor that.
Right. But
there's
then
delay everywhere. And Judge Parrish looked at this. And on the defendant's side of the delay, did she make a finding as why he was delaying?
She did. She makes a specific finding that he was intentionally delaying to manufacture a Speedy Trial Act dismissal. That's a specific finding of Judge Parrish.
And what do we do with that on appeal? Is that a fact finding that is subject to clear error?
That has traditionally been treated as a fact finding. Yes. And so that's our point. Your Honor, Judge Carson, if I can take one more brief stab at your question, here's the concern that we have. Again, if a defendant files motions seriatim, he files a successful motion in year one, he files a successful motion in year two, year three, year four, and so forth, he's going to get the substantive benefit for each of those successful motions. Nobody would dispute that. But if he then comes back in at the end of year five and says, look, I succeeded in year one on that motion, and year two on that motion, and year three on that motion, and year four on that motion, so now give me a timing dismissal. What Kerber one says is no, because on the timing issue, he acquiesced to the delay. And so here, where he waits 3 years to file the suppression motion, that delay is on him. And where he waits 4 years to file the Speedy Trial Act motion, that delay in filing that motion is on him. I mean, on the Speedy Trial, that was the third motion I was referring to. The cases are a little bit fuzzy about when exactly a Speedy Trial Act or a Sixth Amendment timing claim accrues, but they start talking about these claims being viable at a year and a half or so. He waits 4 years to file a Speedy Trial Act motion. If he thinks that he needs to get to trial sooner, he could have filed that motion in 2 years. He makes this claim in the reply brief. He says that he was stopped by Judge Waddup. So he asserts that Judge Waddup said early on that nobody could do anything until the protective order motion was filed. If you go to that citation, it's volume 24, page 5902. What Judge Waddup actually said was that he was going to suspend the motion cutoff until the protective order litigation was resolved. He never says that nobody can file motions. But even beyond that, even if that had been what he had said, he rules on the protective order motion in June of 2011. And yet we're coming back to it. Kerber waits a year and a month to file the suppression motion. And then he waits another 3 years to file his timing motions. So if what we're talking about is timing, and that's what Judge Parrish was looking at with her discretionary authority. And what she's looking at are two things, really. One, he keeps asking for continuances. And if you look at the record, he's saying he hasn't read what he had. And two, he waits 9 months to file a protective order motion, 3 years to file a suppression motion, 4 to 5 years to file a timing motion. How can he possibly get a with prejudice dismissal on a timing motion where he contributed to so much of the delay? And that's where her discretion comes in. And that's it. One final point. I hope I'm not abusing the court's indulgence on the time. He makes this claim that she didn't account for, among others, the suppression ruling. If you look to her ruling, it's the second page of her ruling. It's the appellate appendix, page 2333. This is in her background section. She has a block quote from the suppression ruling. I mean, it's true that when she gets into the Speedy Trial Act analysis factor two, she doesn't then discuss it, but she hadn't been directed to. But she's clearly aware of it. She included a block quote from the suppression ruling in her motion. So she's clearly aware of it. She just didn't think it mattered in light of everything else. I'd be happy to address any further questions on any of the issues. I know there's a lot that's been briefed and talked about.
There's a lot, but I'm frankly enjoying it because we had really good counsel today. Oh. So I'm gonna give Mr. Baldwin, I'm glad to see my colleagues nodding their heads in place, but this is what we live for. So Mr. Baldwin, I'm gonna give you 5 minutes.
Yep. Great. Thank you, Your
Honor. Try to keep it to 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Will do.
Okay.
So I think there's two main points that I think I would like to make sure that I respond to there. The first is Arterbury satisfied the Bice requirement of essentiality. That's consistent with this court's precedent. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but this court has looked at what the final outcome of the case is in a post-Bice decision as the decision in which that issue was decided. So in Bice, that issue that was being decided was the jury's verdict. The final outcome for that decision was the verdict. And there, the court couldn't be certain the jury actually made that decision. In the Hart's opinion that I had cited to you earlier, Your Honor, you reasoned that the issue of bad faith was both necessary and essential to the outcome of the motion for fees. That was after there had even been a jury verdict in that case. That's not essential to the outcome of the entire proceeding. Here, the suppression issues are absolutely essential to the suppression order, and that's the order to which finality attaches for purposes of having the ability to appeal and falls within the reasoning of Arterbury. There was no reason to address the basis for Judge Shelby's decision because it was decided years before Arterbury. Arterbury makes this a foregone conclusion and, frankly, a simple case for this court to decide that that is the error. The second point that I'd like to raise is that so much of the back and forth with the government illustrates the lack of findings by Judge Parrish. And this court's instructions in United States versus Black explains that the court needs to go through that analysis. The exact discussion that this court was just having is precisely what Judge Parris is required to do. And she didn't do. She didn't engage with these questions about, well, what is the relationship? What? So, okay, perhaps Mr. Kerber did take some time to file some things. And, you know, what role did Judge Wattops play in that when he did say, you know what, we're going to extend the deadlines here for pretrial motions because we've got to decide this issue about whether the government has relied on privileged documents first. Secondly, what role could Kerber possibly have played in the government's decision to withhold evidence, including, as this court already found in the prior case, the government still disclosed 1,400 pages of discovery after the district court had signaled that it was going to dismiss the first case. What role could Kerber possibly have played in that? And Judge Parrish's analysis just ignores this entirely. There's no findings about that. It's absolutely lacking under United States versus Black. And if there are no further questions, I think those are the main points that I wanted to make sure.
Let me follow up on mooring, okay?
Yeah.
Now that I'm a little more familiar with it.
Great.
I get it too. So your point that you're making based on mooring is that the determination by the judge in the first case doesn't have to be essential and necessary to the ultimate judgment. It can be necessary and essential to one issue.
Well, the issue needs to be essential to an outcome that then gives rise to the opportunity and incentive for the party to challenge that on appeal and make sure that it is fully and fairly litigated. And that's why a suppression order is unique. And that's why Arterbury was correctly decided, because the government, not the defendant, solely the government can appeal that suppression order. So when the government has an adverse decision on a suppression order, that the issues that were decided in that suppression order are essential to that order, obviously, and that order can then be appealed. And I think what really highlights the strangeness of the government's position here is that when the shoe is on the other foot and a criminal defendant brings a motion to suppress and it's decided against him, the court in the criminal case decides there was no constitutional violation. This court has repeatedly said that that criminal defendant is precluded in the future from raising a 1983 claim premised on those same constitutional violations, because the constitutional determinations in the denied suppression order satisfy the test for issue preclusion and
litigation. I think you're wrong about that. If it's only if the decision in the suppression motion was essential to the conviction.
A denied suppression motion couldn't ever be the sole determinative factor of conviction. A defendant is never convicted because the government didn't violate his constitutional rights. That would be the analysis that would be required under the government's test. If it's the sole dispositive reason for the conviction that the government didn't violate his constitutional rights, that can't possibly be the outcome.
We do allow Section 1983 litigation by someone who's been convicted after losing a motion to suppress when the alleged constitutional violation was not necessary for the was not an issue in the suppression. For example, the use of excessive force after something. Well, listen, I...
Yes.
Well, to clarify,
Your Honor, it's that the issue in the suppression order is then barred from being relitigated. It's not that there is no opportunity for a 1983 claim going forward on some other violation, but The violation that was adjudicated in the motion to suppress, even when it was denied, which necessarily could not be essential to that defendant's conviction or acquittal in the end, that has been held to be issue preclusion applies to that issue under Banks v. OPAT, Thompson v. Platt, and McNally v. Colorado State Patrol. This court has decided that issue repeated.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. Case is submitted. Counselor excused.